Probing space and time. Probing for the truth. What is this phone? What are they? From where or whence do they come? What is their purpose? Why is it happening? Why do they both reveal and lurk in the shadows simultaneously? This is the probe.
Welcome, welcome to The Probe. This is the second episode of The Probe. It's a talk show about UFOs and associated impact on our culture. I'm here with my co-host Robert Selby and Edward O'Reilly. On today's episode, we're going to delve into our first alien abduction cases, namely the Travis Walton experience. And then we're going to actually pick up where we left off in episode one and talk about the seminal classic sci-fi movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. But first, we're going to talk about Travis Walton from Snowflake, Arizona, and what happened to him back in November 5th, 75. Perhaps I should just play a clip of Travis talking, guys, and explaining what happened, or do we want to do a little preliminary exploration here?
Well, let's maybe talk a little bit about
just what happened. And, you know, what actually they made a popular movie out of this too called Fire in the Sky back in the 80s, was it? Late 70s, 80s?
All those decades are starting to blur together for me now, so I'm not sure. Might have been 90s.
I forget who played, what was the guy's name who played Walton? But James Garner, who I mentioned a lot of people are familiar with, Maverick and Rockford Files, he played an investigator.
Have you ever tried to find out why all these decades are blurred together in your mind? I hear that's one of the after effects of being abducted, that all the decades seem to blur together.
No, well, that's just the hours, not the decades. But
Well, it depends on how many times you've been abducted.
Well, that's true. That's true.
So,
and Mr. O'Connor, we don't know how many times he's been abducted, but one can speculate on that.
Well, and we want to keep our audience in suspense, so that'll be a future episode, probably episode 35 or so, when we get to how many times I've been abducted.
And he'll show his implants.
You can't show implants on the radio, O'Reilly.
Well, we'd do one of those live, what were you talking about a few minutes ago? We'll get a live cab thing.
Right.
Yeah.
People can tune in and see you guys throttling each other. Well, let's have Travis talk for himself and just say a couple minutes here, just to give the listeners a little bit of a sense of exactly what happened back in 76 in Arizona. So here goes. This is Travis Walton in his own words here on The Probe.
Before we worked till dark and loaded up the equipment, we're headed home. I was sitting by the door in the front. Ken Peterson was in the middle. Mike was driving, and there was four guys in the back of the truck. I was in a good position to notice the glimmers of light coming through the trees, me and one of the first ones to see it. Here's this glow coming through the trees, little glimmers here and there, and I'm thinking, what could that be, you know? And then, that don't look right. And, you know, one by one, all these little conversations amongst the crew dropped off, so I was thinking, maybe deer hunters, because, you know, we'd actually heard some shooting in the distance during the day. It was deer hunting season. I said, Mike, hurry up, get up there, let's see what it is. Just as soon as we got to where that light was crossing the road, boom, there it was. It was just unmistakable. Less than 100 feet away, as close as from here to the back of the room, there it was, metallic disc hovering there, outlined against the sky. Alan was in the back, Alan Dallas, he was next to the door. And he yelled out, it's a flying saucer or a spaceship, something like that. Immediately, I mean, there was no mistaking what we're looking at. I was immediately thinking that this thing would take off. And I, just on impulse, got out and headed towards this thing. And then when they got alarmed, I was scared. I'm not trying to pretend that I was being extremely brave. I was being extremely foolish. But they started, yelling at me to get back in the truck. But I started to move not so quickly in that direction, you know. I got to thinking that this could be dangerous, so I slowed down, and as I got to where, you know, I was looking up at about, like a 45 degree angle. Those guys were getting more and more scared, you know, swearing at me, calling me all kinds of names, and wanting me to get back in the truck. And I was, you know, leaning that way real heavy, but suddenly it got louder and it started to move. And so I just dove for cover, just kind of a reflex. There was a log sticking up there, and I got down behind the log. And those, they were saying, let's go, let's go. I decided to stand up and run back to the truck. And right when I stood up is when I felt this shock go through my body, like I'd raised up underneath something. And I instantly blacked out. It threw me through the air. Steve said like 25 feet. But John said that the way my body fell, like a sack of meat, like there were just no bones in my body, you know. So that they called in the state police lie detector experts.
And that is Travis Walton in his own words describing what happened back in November 5th, 75. And pretty cool. To re-encapsulate what Travis was saying, the Walton incident is seven guys. The crew chief was the oldest, Mike Rogers. He was 28. He was good friends with Travis Walton. The youngest guy lied about his age. He was only 17. He wanted the job. They had a contract, clear brush, to try and keep it this national forest that they were going to from a forest fire risk. And they put in a long day.
They were loggers, right?
Well, they're referred to as loggers, but really what it was is Mike Rogers had a contract and he hired a bunch of people on contract to come out and chainsaw and lug wood and so forth. So we call them loggers if you want. They're not loggers. Maybe you would think in terms of permanent employment in the forestry industry, they were clearing brush to reduce the fire or fire hazard. And they had seven of them in the truck. So we're getting late at night. They're going back to town and she saw something through the trees, a light. And they thought maybe it was a forest fire. You know, lightning strikes. They have a lot of lightning strikes in that area, maybe the highest or second highest rate of lightning strikes in the continental USA. They rounded the corner and basically there was a UFO. Seven of them witnessed it, a large UFO. And Travis was the person closest to the passenger door. Well, the fool jumps out.
Yeah, you kind of wonder why he did that. But I guess he was a bit of a daredevil.
Well, yeah, a little bit of a hellraiser, but he said, you know, I was scared too, but he was trying to explain what his mindset was when he did it. And he said it was two things. One was, he said, normally, maybe you would see a bear or something. And he said, well, you'd only get a glimpse of it and it'd be gone. So he said, in my mind, I thought this object was going to disappear really quick. So he said, I started off toward it. He said, the other thing that was going on was all the guys started going like, holy crap, it's a spaceship or a UFO or something like that. Get back in the car. They were all freaked out. And he said, no, I started to get scared too. But he said, because they were acting so scared, I was trying to be the tough guy. But he said, my pace going toward the UFO started to slacken.
It's almost like a case of curiosity killed the cat, right? Almost, except it didn't kill him. But I wonder if in subsequent years, if he's ever regretted. Well, it depends whether he's regretted the experience or not. It's certainly something that, you know, not very many people have experienced, certainly not to with the fame, if you want to call it that, that he's acquired. That can be a double-edged sword, I suppose. But something you can do something sometimes and you wonder yourself afterwards, you know, what was I thinking? You know?
Yeah, I'm sure I've got lots of events like that too where you've done something and later on you think, you know, what on earth? Bobby maybe never had that kind of experience, but Ed and I think we're fessing up to... Yeah. You ever do something you can't explain it? Let's get some.
He's back, yeah, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Mr. Thurman himself.
Bobby Selby.
Oh.
Thank you very much. Everyone applaud.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know what's interesting here? I think why this is such a famous case is you've got seven people in a truck.
Yeah.
All witnessing the exact same thing. Travis gets out, and by the time he figures, what the hell am I doing? This is crazy. And heeding the call of his coworkers and friends, he said, just got up to dart back to the truck, and he said, something came out of the UFO and zapped him. And he describes it similar to a static electric charge. He speculates on what it might have been. He said,
was he lifted up when the beam hit him?
Well, no. In fact, he just described it that he was thrown back like a bag of meat. The guys thought he was dead. They were so freaked out, they thought he was dead, that he'd just been killed, and they tore off. They raced away to save their own lives.
Now, was that when he went out and the beam hit him, was he immediately thrown back?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Whatever. And it's almost like he was zapped with something.
One of them thought that he was incinerated.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I think the other one, another one did think that he was thrown up in the air and then came down hard, and that led him to think that he must be dead.
Right.
So one wonders, what was he hit with? Because apparently they didn't try to take him on board the craft right away. He was almost like...
Well, we don't know. He speculates that he said, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time and they injured me by accident. And once they had done it, they had some sort of ethical or moral obligation to try and do something about it and took him aboard the craft. No one was around to witness how that happened. He just woke up on the craft.
They had left by that point.
And by the time they had gathered the wits, and the oldest one was 28 years old, Mike Rogers, he was the crew chief, and he said he was going back. And the guys, they didn't want to go back. They were feared for their lives, but he gave them a choice. They could stand in the dark, and he'd come back and get them when he was done looking for Travis, or they could come with him. In the movie, half of them stood in the dark. He said, in reality, he said, none of them stood in the dark. After seeing a UFO and zapping their friend, none of them were willing to stand out in the woods by themselves by the side of the road. No, thank you. They all stayed in the truck, all six of the remaining people.
One of them, I really enjoyed that part. He described the ship, and he said it was terrifying, but in a way it was beautiful, because evidently it had these glass panels, mm-hmm. kind of in a fan shape. And so he was terrified, but it was beautiful. And you were talking about, is it Mike Rogers?
Yeah, he's the crew chief.
He's the one that felt the most guilt, I guess, maybe because he knew Travis the longest. He felt...
Well, they were best friends.
Okay. And that's why he felt so guilty about just leaving him behind. And he had to, whether the other guys wanted to go or not, he had to go back.
He just got control of his fear and realized that they had to go back. So they went back. Yeah. And they couldn't find Travis. They, you know, it's dark. He said they kept within physical contact of each other. So you got six people out where Travis was. He had ducked behind a pile of brush, a log, to observe the UFO. When he stood up, that's when he got zapped. They saw that, you know, he'd been zapped, and one thought he was incinerated, but he was thrown back. Well, they couldn't find him. So they gave up the search. He just wasn't there, and reported it to the police. The police
suspected
right away. Yeah. Who's going to believe a cockamamie story like that?
And you can't blame the cops for that either, because, you know.
Well, you should be skeptical, right?
Yeah.
But they think these guys killed.
Yeah.
Their coworker, buried him somewhere. That's what they think.
So the townspeople.
Right.
Yeah.
Under a great amount of suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the most interesting things about the case for me, and we'll hear them talking about these polygraphs, but the police brought in their state polygraph expert. Now, a polygraph has a 92 to 95% success rate. That is, if you're telling a lie 92 to 95% of the time, it will detect it. So it's not infallible by any stretch.
No, we should mention they aren't admissible in court, at least in the States. I don't think they are here either.
Anymore.
By the way, to give the police a bit of credit, although I really think they wanted someone responsible for the disappearance, and as they thought it was that they did him, you know, they murdered him or something, and they were trying to cover it up. But they did search for 4 days. They had a huge crew, and they searched for 4 days to try and find Travis before they called in the polygraph guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's quite a thorough search.
Well, what day did they call in the polygraph guy? I'm not really sure, Bob.
After 4 days of search, they began to think, yeah, the guys must be covering up, and then they ordered the polygraph.
When they were searching, though, they were looking for freshly dug earth and stuff too.
They
were looking for Travis one way or the other.
Yeah.
So let's talk about so there's seven guys, one guy's missing. Travis Walton is missing. There's six guys that are under a cloud of suspicion. They've come back with this really crazy, hard to believe story. And the police have done this big search with all these volunteers, all these people out in the area, and they can't find any sign whatsoever of Travis Walton. And so they say to the guys, if you don't have anything to hide, take a polygraph. So there's six of them. They want to take a polygraph test.
Yeah.
And of the six, five passed. The one that didn't pass was inconclusive. He didn't fail.
Yeah.
He had some trouble with the law, and he didn't want to answer the questions and refused to answer the questions. So you can't, in other words, the polygraph didn't render a decision of any sort on him.
This is the thing. I mean, they were helpless. As I was watching the story and listening to it, I just thought, wouldn't they have had maybe a lawyer by then, or shouldn't they have had a lawyer?
Didn't they have a lawyer?
I don't think so. No.
And actually, I'm glad they did take the polygraph test, because it was an expert that administered it.
Yeah.
And the
police expert. They're looking to find out that they're lying, and then they can start to squeeze these people who committed a homicide.
But were they legally obligated to take that test?
Well,
because they weren't charged with anything.
Probably not. But again, remember, the youngest one in the crew was 17 years old. Most of them are in their early 20s. I mean, the oldest of the bunch is 28 years old. So
they were all equally scared, though, young and old.
Right. And they didn't have anything to hide. So six take it. Well, six started down the path of taking it. One basically balked. He didn't have confidence in it. And five passed.
Yeah. And then eventually Walton shows up. And, of course, that adds more to it. But if you look at...
Well, let's just hear Travis talk about the polygraph test. It's a 30-second little clip here. Yeah, here we go. Travis Walton talking about the polygraphs.
When they passed, the president of the American Polygraph Association said, polygraph's not 100%. It's in the 90-some percentile repeatedly in research done, for many years. But when you have six people passing tests on the same issue, the odds are over 1,000,000 to 1 of there being any kind of mistake. At this point, there's 16 or 17 passed tests in connection with this incident.
Okay, so if you don't take a polygraph, I mean, despite its pretty good success record, a person can't be exonerated or convicted on the evidence from a polygraph.
Well, that's today. I don't know what the law was back in 1975.
No, I don't think then either. I don't think it was. I'm not sure about that. It's American law, not ours. Anyway, but there's only three scenarios with this, right? If you look at it. One, they killed him and they were trying to cover it up. Obviously, that's not true because he shows up a few days later. But they were concerned about that. Two, and the remaining two after the prospect of him being murdered was eliminated by his live body walking in, was a hoax that they made the whole thing up and it's just a publicity stunt. Or three, it was real and it happened. So that's what you're left with in this case. In most cases, it's either made up or it's real. And that's where the polygraph comes in. Now, has anyone ever independently looked at six people passing? He said over 1,000,000 to 1. Is that right?
Yeah, I did it. I actually did the math. Well, I'm not smart enough to do the math by myself, but my son's a mathematician. So I asked him, and I said, let's give the polygraph the lowest possible reliability rating of 92%. So it's got a range of accuracy 92 to 95, according to studies. So let's say 92%. What are the chances that five people could pass that test?
Right.
And eventually, Travis took the test, and the sixth guy that had bought...
Six people.
He took it, so seven people took it. Well, if you add up the six that took it within the 5 days, because Travis reappears, they all passed.
Yeah.
So if you do the math on it, it's something like 1 in 2.8 million for six.
Yeah, because it's 92 to 95% multiplied six times.
Well, you do one minus 0.92 to the power of 6.
I used to be able to do that stuff myself.
Right. So it's one in, so I did the math. It's 1 in 2.8 million. So he says one in a million. It's actually a little higher than that. Maybe he was only thinking of the initial five that passed.
Yeah.
But if you include him, it's 1 in 2.8 million.
So it means it's a million to one odds that this is a legitimate case.
I was quite impressed
more
with
than
the...
that, 3 million to one.
3 million to one case.
Yeah. I was quite impressed with the gentleman that administered the test. He was the state expert in polygraph. And those guys, they didn't have a lot going for them. The local police would have gladly locked them up for the murder, for the disappearance, but that was the only defense that they did have. And this guy was an expert, and he said pretty much after, you know, took a whole day, he said, they're not guilty. You know, they're not lying, he said. And that really threw the sheriff for a loop.
Well, there's another aspect to consider too, guys, right? So we got what happened at that time. You got five people passed immediately. Travis Walton reappears. He passes, even though it was a different polygraph examiner. And eventually the sixth guy passes. So seven out of seven passes. If it was a hoax, that's one of your three scenarios, right, Ed? If it was
murder,
a hoax
or reality.
Right. All seven people are still alive today. As of the airing of this show, they're all alive. What are the odds, if it was a hoax, that one of them didn't break with the pack?
Yeah.
What's in it for them but ridicule, humiliation, unwanted fame? Some of them went in hiding.
Some of them had to leave the town.
Yeah.
So when I think about that part too, and I think about human nature, it's like, unless this was premeditated and well planned out, and you had seven people who were really close friends. Well, they weren't. They were co-workers. Yeah, Mike and Travis were close friends. Travis and Dallas had been known to have fist fights. That's one of the reasons why Dallas was the one that refused to take the polygraph, because he had some trouble with the law, and he and Travis didn't get along so well. So you're not talking about a close group that are going to conspire and stick to it for 40-some years. I mean, do I do the math right there? 75, 25, 32?
I mean, it's unlikely, and they didn't get anything out of it. You could say, okay, play devil's advocate and say Travis Walton got a book deal and got a movie, so I imagine he got a bit of money off that, and he's done the lecture circuit ever since, but they haven't. So what would their put him aside for the moment? What would be their motivation to go along? I mean, it was not exactly a cash cow either. One book, one movie 40 years ago. You know, it's not something you could make a living on indefinitely, and certainly they haven't. So they have absolutely no motivation whatsoever to perpetuate this deception for 40 years.
Mark, can you answer this is the one point where I was kind of mystified. And he did. Travis was thoroughly examined. They took him to, was it Tucson? What's the capital of Arizona?
Phoenix?
They took him to Phoenix and doctors examined him. And what was the injection site that they found on his arm? Mind you, they didn't find any, they did a tox screen. They didn't find any chemicals, any drugs in his body. But I wonder what that injection site was.
Well, it was a possible injection site. They were saying all the health records were perfect. All the blood tests, all the tox screens, everything they did showed him in perfect health. And there was a possible injection site on his arm. So, you know, you think, well, where did that come from? When he showed up, it was 5 days later. And he's in his brother-in-law's car when they pick him up at a phone booth.
Naked, wasn't he? Just above.
No, he was clothed. In the movie, he might have been naked.
I think he was naked in the movie. They added that. I think. Okay.
Yeah, well, the actor was attractive, so he had to be naked. But in reality, he wasn't naked.
It's been a while since I've seen the movie, but I just remember the scene. I think he grabbed some kind of a thing to wrap himself in when he went on the phone, because I think he came back without any clothes in the movie, but apparently in real life.
I think the three of us, there's no skeptics here, the three of us are gone. You got seven eyewitnesses. They all passed polygraph.
Yeah,
it's 42 years later. None of them are broken with the story. None of them have been able to enrich themselves from it. They don't have any motivation. The odds, the statistical odds of passing these polygraph tests are astronomically slim. So that part we're all in agreement with. They saw what they saw. They describe it. Bob described the UFO, the object. It wasn't mistaken lights. It wasn't other things. And there were other witnesses in the area who observed the object. They weren't the only ones.
Now, was there ever any hypnotic regression done?
Okay, so we're getting to part B. Now, this is where we have to decide if we believe the story or not.
Okay.
Thank you, Bob. We need the ambiance. Part B is, Travis says when he comes back, I was in the craft. I was brought into the craft. I woke up. I was being examined. He had a whole story. And we don't have time to go into all the details of the story, but he says, without hypnotic regression, he remembers it all. The stories he was telling 30 years ago versus 15 years ago versus 5 years ago versus today are identical. No. He doesn't waver. He doesn't elaborate or fabricate. He just tells what he remembers. He just says, I was abducted. There were these beings that freaked me out. They didn't seem to be able to maintain control. They ran away. Then these very human-like people showed up wearing almost like spacesuits.
Were they grays?
No, they were not.
They were humanoid. Their eyes were kind of looked like robots. And he said there was something strange about their eyes. They took over from the four-foot aliens that ran away.
Right. But he thought, you know, he was saying, what's going on? Because he thought they were human beings. So he was talking to them like, fill me in. Where am I? What's going on?
They didn't talk to him back, did they?
They did not. And they basically ushered him to a whole other place on the, what we'll call a mothership for a better word.
It was a hangar with other vehicles, space vehicles in the hangar. And they led him down a ramp, which is kind of reminiscent of the day the Earth stood still.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and then they basically put him under. Right? He probably needed some medical attention.
I know he was really, really scared, but he's one of the few abduction stories that I've heard. And that goes back to that daredevil business. He managed to tear himself off the table and he got up and he started, you know, threatening the aliens. That's why they went away. For some reason, they were maybe afraid of him. And another thing about his story, I was surprised that he thought that they were trying to sort of heal him for the damage that happened to him when he was still outside the ship. Because usually you expect those abductees to have experiments and implants done on them. Do you know anything more about that, Mark? About they had this sort of apparatus on his chest. And it fell off when he got up.
Yeah, I don't know if there was any kind of stories of implants in this particular case.
Now, he said afterwards he had the impression that they brought him aboard because he was injured in the initial, when the beam hit.
He's got a theory. He doesn't know this for sure, but that's his theory.
But it does kind of sound like they were at least doing more than healing, that they were, you know, examining him, whether they put implants in or not, but that there was some kind of, well, we got this guy now, we might as well take a look at him type.
Well, we're going to have to move on. He wasn't, you know, the thing that impresses me is he passed the lie detector test about what he believes happened, that he was on a UFO. The stories remain consistent.
So is there anything we can point to?
Seven people observed the craft up close.
Yeah.
A bunch of other people, hunters and campers, also observed the UFO that night in that area. Their statements were taken by the sheriff. They're on the historical record. So we got a lot of witnesses saying there was something. And we got Travis's story about what happened when he was, in his view, accidentally injured due to his stupidity.
3 million to one odds that they were not lying. So this is what's interesting about this case is that it's a rather hard one to debunk. There's no smoking gun that you can say, there's something, this is the phony or this is a lie.
Something's kind of missing from our broadcast so far today.
What's that?
Music.
There's no skeptic. We're all pretty.
Well, that's what I'm getting to now. Is there anything that we can look at that would say, okay, this doesn't quite ring
well,
true?
I'm not sure. What I would say by passing a polygraph, and again, it's a 92% reliability at the low end of the threshold.
Yeah.
So his story with the UFO, he's the only one that had that experience. There's no one to corroborate him going onto the craft. There's no one to corroborate what happened on the craft. He passes the polygraph, multiple polygraphs actually over the years on that matter. So I'm convinced he believes all that he's telling us. Did it actually happen?
If you take the 3 million to 1 odds that all six guys, well, seven including him, that whatever part that they played in this abduction case was true, that's, you know, it's very unlikely that they were lying given the 92 to 95%. And then when you take them as a group, it's even much more unlikely that they were lying. So look at the different aspects. You've got, apart from those guys, you've got the witnesses to the UFO. You've got being seen to be hit by a beam. You've got his experiences being hit by the beam, then waking up on board. All of that is under that umbrella of 92 to 95% accuracy. So there's not really a lot here. Granted, he was the only one being looked at.
Well,
but there's not a lot here to say, okay, it doesn't...
It's one of the most interesting cases. What we need to move on to our second subject, and we got a little musical interlude for you, courtesy of Robert Selby. What did you bring for us today, Robert?
I brought Clara Rockmore, who was a virtuoso on the theremin. She was acquainted with the gentleman that invented the theremin, some Russian professor.
When was that?
I think it was in the late 1940s.
So let's have a musical selection.
We'll listen to Clara Rockmore, and beautiful concert music. It's not spooky, but it is kind of spooky.
Well, it's got the theremin in it, spooky enough. So here we go, a little interlude, folks, and then we're going to come back and talk about Bob's favorite sci-fi film, the seminal classic from the mid-50s, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Hang on for more from The Probe. And we just got finished listening to a wonderful musical selection from Clara Rockwood, the theremin. It sounds like a soprano singer. In fact, you see Clara Rockwood, you're thinking that's what you're hearing is her singing, but it's actually the theremin. Am I correct in that, Bob?
Exactly. It sounds like a human voice, but it is the theremin. And she happens to be, I mean, I can play around with the theremin, but that lady is a virtuoso. She experimented and studied it so much so that she can play classical music on the theremin. She is since deceased. That's a I was lucky to find that recording.
Well, it's wonderful. We'll play more, I think, on future episodes. It's just so transportative.
It sounds like
out of this world.
It sounds like she's singing.
It does. It sounds very. That's, you know, I would have sworn she was a soprano singer,
yeah,
but it's
human voice.
I really enjoyed that.
Vox humana.
Vox humana. Well, actually, that is the wonderful thing about, and I'm, you know, from the singing myself, and the musicianship that goes along with that, but instrumentalists are often told by their teachers, you know, that they may be a violinist or a pianist or whatever, but they're told to make their instrument sing, pretend it's the singing voice, and that gives you the basic innate musicality that you would need for your instrument. So she is doing that with, that's her instrument, the theremin, and she is making the instrument sing, literally.
Right.
It's quite an art.
Yeah, it really is. Well, we've got the little mini theremin here, and controlling it is, you know, we can, you know, we're having great fun goofing around with it, but it would take real skill to.
We're not we're not virtuosi.
That's for sure.
We're not even OCs.
And certainly not virtuous.
We're more amateur-OCs.
Yeah, amateur-OCs. There we go. All right, let's Bob, let's go on to your favorite sci-fi film. In the first episode, at The Last Element, we talked about it a little bit, and you actually read the famous final speech by Klaatu. Tell us about the film and why you love it so much. Why is it your favorite?
I love that movie a lot. It was produced in 1951. And it has sort of overtones of giving a message to the world. And I think probably it would have been Hiroshima and Roswell had an effect on the message of that movie.
Maybe we should give our listeners just a little bit of a plot synopsis so they know what the movie's about. If you're not familiar with it, what actually happened? What's the story?
Oh, okay. It's on a nice spring day in Washington. Although the this fast-moving flying object is sighted all over the world and reports are going out, but it finally lands on the Mall.
Not the White House lawn, by the way, but the Mall.
On the Mall.
Yeah.
What's the Mall?
The Mall is it's sort of a park area.
Like Central Park?
Yeah, only in Washington. I guess the pictures that you see, although the actors never made it to Washington, D.C., I don't know, a lot of it was filmed on Hollywood lots, but the landing of the ship is for 1951. For me, I don't know. It's really great. I think it's terrific when it lands. I really find it to be quite believable.
Yeah, it's very. It doesn't look. You know, sometimes even if they have good plots, 50s sci-fi can be a little chintzy in the special effects.
Well, if a flying saucer landed, that's what you'd want it to look like.
Yeah. And
okay, so a flying saucer lands.
It lands
in a Central Park in Washington.
In Washington, yes, and it's. It's there for several hours and nothing happens, and you don't see any seams or anything where you could get into the spaceship. But suddenly, seams appear and it opens up and there's a ramp, and this humanoid figure, although his face is covered at first by his costume, you don't see him, mm-hmm. but he's in this sort of shiny costume, and he comes out and he tells everyone that he comes in peace.
So who's everyone?
People have gathered. Well, the army makes sort of a cordon?
Yeah,
and they're sort of the line to keep people back. But there's a lot of.
Do they have a general there with a bouquet of roses to greet this fellow?
No,
there's no.
No,
roses.
They have actually. Oh, okay, I know what he's getting at. They do have their tanks and artillery at the ready, and these armed guards make a chain to keep the pedestrians, the general citizen people back from going too close to the ship. So anyway, Klaatu is his name. The alien comes off and says, I am here in peace. So, you know, in other words, don't be alarmed. And he goes, walks towards...
In other words, don't shoot me.
Don't shoot me. And he walks towards the army and the people. And suddenly he takes something out of his pocket. And
he unfurls it.
Well, it springs open.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the nervous servicemen there, army people, shoots him because he thinks it's a weapon. So he falls down, and then suddenly,
my favorite part of the movie, or one of them,
suddenly the robot, played by a 7'6" actor, but of course he has a robot costume on, appears from the ship, and then everyone starts screaming and running away of the real people, and the army people are ready to shoot and whatever. So he comes off and he starts, the robot has a little visor, and the visor opens up, and he has a laser beam, and the laser beam sort of vaporizes all the metallic objects, all the tanks and guns and everything. So
he disarms them.
He disarms them. They're sort of there naked. And then finally the alien recovers a little bit, and he says, "Gort, I can't remember the exact words, but in other words,
something to be Brazo or something. I can't remember.
Give him a code word, so he stops. This
is a family show. Though, yeah. Stop talking about Brazos, will you?
Yeah,
you
know, Edward.
Gort, bugger off is probably what he said.
Get your mind out of that alien gutter.
That was macho.
Now that scene, that moment, and I've read about this in a seminal, which referred to as a seminal science fiction film, that scene where he first appears, and I won't do justice to the music, but anyone who's heard the music, you probably heard it at some point. No, it's not it's kind of a theremin. It goes, dum, dum, dum.
Yeah, it's a big.
And you just see him in the distance, gleaming in the sunlight, staring down at them. That is one creepy moment.
So we got an alien visiting us in a saucer-shaped craft with a robot as his muscle. And he's declared he's come in peace.
Yeah.
They take him off to heal his gunshot wounds, and he basically decamps from the hospital and gets to know people one-on-one, because darn it all, he looks exactly like us. Yeah. You don't know that he's an alien. He's not green. He's not little. He's not gray.
No pointed ears.
He's
no
a humanoid.
He looks just like one of us.
And he looks a lot like Michael Rennie.
Yeah, very much like Michael Rennie.
And actually, Michael Rennie did participate in a few of those religious movies, and he very much is kind of a Christ figure. And the writer and the producers of the film were very much aware of that. And there are a lot of religious metaphors in this movie. It's someone who comes from above to give the good news to give a message. The name that he assumes is John Carpenter, and the initials are JC, and Jesus's father was a carpenter.
That was deliberate.
Well, yeah, it was sort of subliminal, but not subliminal.
Yeah.
And Michael Rennie is the perfect, 6'4", and he has that sort of narrow face, and plus he was in the robe, and I don't know if the robe was after this.
That was after. He got the robe because of Klaatu, I think.
So Klaatu basically slips away and becomes one of the common unwashed on Earth.
But he's a hunted man.
Yeah, he escapes. They try to sequester him in the hospital.
Why did he want to go underground, undercover?
He wanted to find out what actually the common people think about what's going on in the world before a guy comes from the president and he asks Klaatu, "Do you want to talk to the president?" And he said, "No, I want to talk to all the world leaders." But because it was the beginning of the Cold War, it was difficult. One big power wouldn't meet unless it was in Washington or Great Britain. They wouldn't go to Russia. Russia wouldn't come to the United States. Yeah. So,
why did the flying saucer choose to land in the Mall in Washington? Why didn't it land in Budapest?
The movie kind of addresses that. There's a scene as far as him getting out. He's Mr. Harley. I always remember that name because my sister had a cat, Harley, who lived for almost 20 years. So, no, it's a true story. That's not a weird thing. That's Harley was the cat. And Mr. Harley, I think of the cat every time I see the movie. And he says to Mr. Harley, "Do you want some catnip?" No, he says to Mr. Harley, perhaps if I move among the people, I might find out the source for these unreasoning attitudes. And he wants to find out what humans are all about. And of course, now there's another, you talk about the Washington landing. Well, there's a scene, I think Mr. Harley says to him, now that you've got all this international UN crap out of the way, perhaps you can meet with the president, you know, the only country that counts. And he's got this, for a 1951 film, for an American film, and it was a Hollywood film to say this, he says, I have no intention, he says, of adding my contribution to your unreasoning paranoia and suspicions. In other words, if I favor one country, every other country's going to think, okay, I'm, you know, on the side of the good old USA and everybody else is in trouble. I don't want to add to that. I'm not here to solve your petty domestic squabbles. He says that as well. So one, I think one of the reasons the film has lasted so long is it's really kind of enlightened point of view.
Well, I want to, Bob, I want to get back to why you enjoyed it so much, but I have one question because, you know, I watched the film because it's your favorite. The title. I don't understand the title.
Oh, okay. It originally had another title, and I didn't write that down. But the title was very. Let me think. Let me see if I can remember why they chose that. Because they were.
I mean, the world didn't physically stand still. It was still evolving.
Yeah, that was his. In order to demonstrate his power, he went to. Dr. Zorba, actually Dr. Barnhart, who was supposed to be the most clever scientist in the United States, he went to meet with him, yeah. And he tells Dr. Barnhart that if the United States or if the world does not, if the Earth does not stop doing their nuclear experiments or arming any nuclear vehicles, the Earth will be reduced to a burned out cinder, yeah. And then
we come in peace, but we carry a big weapon.
That's right. And well, it's not him. Don't blame Klaatu, because the robots have been empowered to quash any signs of
this was the first RoboCop.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, independent of the people that live on the planet, these are their policemen, as he calls them. So anyway,
So he sounds like a lunatic because he looks like a human and he's talking like a crazy person. So he has to persuade Dr. Barnhart.
Well, he's not entirely, you know, there is a Christ-like metaphor with it, but there's also a scene where she says, Barnhart, what must I do to get attention? Leveling New York City, perhaps?
So sinking the Rock of Gibraltar?
Well, that would be a little less destructive than New York City.
So what did he propose to do? And is it got something to do with the title?
He proposed to make everything in the world stop for a half an hour, except airplanes and hospitals.
So it stood still.
Ah, right.
It stood still, and that would demonstrate the, you know, Dr. Barnhart says such power exists. And then Michael Rennie says, I can assure you such power exists. So then he suggests
such
that.
Such power and more.
He
sounds like a modern day kind of person I'm familiar with.
Well, he's got this peaceful message about we should live in peace and stop worrying on each other. But if you're going to live like that, you confine it to your own planet. But there is, you know, there's always been kind of a dark side to this, that if you guys don't measure up, we're going to get rid of you.
And,
you
know, here are some of the terms that are used for what will happen to the Earth. First, the Earth will be eliminated, or it'll be reduced to a burned out cinder.
Yeah.
Or he also says, pursue your present course or face obliteration. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, Klaatu moves into a rooming house, and he befriends this widow with her little boy. And towards the end, he has to confide in her because he needs her help, because he wants to have that conference. It ends up not being United Nations, but a United Nations of scientists that is organized by Dr. Barnhart. And he has to teach her. He says, if anything happens to me, because Gort is empowered.
Gort's the robot.
Yeah. By the way, Gort, all this time, is standing outside of the ship, and they can't move him. They can't. also the ship, they try to bore holes into it, but they can't. It's a material that's impregnable. Yeah. So Gort is just standing there doing nothing, and they put a layer of polymer, of plastic, on him so he won't move or anything. But anyway, it comes to the point where where he wants to go to the conference, and they're driving in the taxi towards the spaceship, and Klaatu, the alien, starts to worry. Well, if anything happens to me, Gort will destroy the Earth.
Yeah.
And so he has to, Klaatu does have a little bit of, humanity for the Earth. So he teaches this lady from the boarding house, mini sentence uttered by an alien in films.
Do all this together, shall we? Do you know the words?
I don't.
One, okay. Two, three.
Klaatu Barada.
Nikto. But you're just like Mr. Harley. He comes in and says, oh, you're Mr. Klaatu. And Michael Rennie says, Klaatu.
What did I say?
You said Klaatu like Mr. Harley, your hero.
The cat.
You pronounce it like a maritimer, Ed.
But anyway,
he can do it like an alien. Oh,
yeah. Anyway, he teaches it to her, and he does. Eventually, the army comes after them. He gets shot,
yeah.
And so she has to go to Gort because Gort senses this, and we see that the plastic is falling off him, and she has to go and say, "A Gort, Klaatu Barada Nikto." So then he doesn't destroy things. He goes and gets Michael Rennie out of
There's one thing in before that. Just before she says those words, he does kill. There's two guards, and
right,
they wander up to, and you know, because he's melting the plastic, and all of a sudden the rays that came out and melted the guns and the tanks before hit them, and like if on Star Trek,
that's collateral damage. That,
yeah, that not doesn't, to those guys
that doesn't really matter. So anyway, he goes and gets Klaatu. He bores through this wall in the prison, takes him back to the ship. And he brings him back to life, and the lady from the boarding house says, oh, does Gort have the power between life and death? And the censors would not allow that, so they built in this little phrase. Klaatu says, no, that can only be done by the Almighty Spirit.
All right.
So the Almighty Spirit brings him, yeah.
Yes, has
the,
yes,
owned
yes.
A Christian Hollywood at the time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, guys, the time, as always...
And they remade it not very well.
The time, as always, has disappeared. We're missing time, apparently, because we just started the show 2 minutes ago.
Yes. What happened in the last 50 minutes?
We don't know. We don't know. We're going to undergo hypnosis, and we'll be back with episode 3 soon to tell you what we find out, what's happened. Yes, thank you, thank you. And we're going to play another selection from Clara Rockwood just to leave our audience, and you do tune in to The Probe for another... scary, creepy, funny, exasperating episode in the near future.
That's the best one, exasperating.
Okay, here we go with Clara Rockwood and some nice theremin music.